July 4th, 1951, Independence Day. But this year, a very special occasion. Today marks the 175th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence by our founding fathers. And today marks the beginning of a year of rededication by our people to those principles of the oldest and most inspiring document of freedom, the Declaration of Independence. On May 17th of this year, the President of the United States issued a proclamation and an executive order setting up a commission to commemorate the 175th anniversary. This group is headed by the Chief Justice of the United States, the Honorable Fred Vinson, and includes the Vice President, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and the majority and minority leaders of both House and Senate. This commission has worked long and hard and well to make this Independence Day one of special significance. 60 major cities throughout our land and innumerable smaller communities today held special rededication services. The Voice of America has spread the ringing words of freedom of the Declaration throughout the world in almost all the tongues of man. Thus is proclaimed to the nation and the world the powerful and inspiring words of the basic philosophy of the United States, that all men are created equal and are endowed with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To climax this day of rededication, the President of the United States has come to one of the great shrines and symbols of our nation, the Washington Monument in the nation's capital, to speak to an audience of 200,000 gathered here, to speak to the people of the United States, and to speak to the people of the world. He will be introduced by the Honorable F. Joseph Donohue, Commissioner of the District of Columbia. Commissioner Donohue.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
President of the United States.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, this is a very special occasion. Here in Washington tonight, up in Philadelphia, and throughout our whole country, we are celebrating an anniversary of great importance. On this day, 175 years ago, the representatives of the American people declared the independence of the United States. Our forefathers in Philadelphia not only established a new nation, they established a nation based on a new idea. They said that all men were created equal. They based the whole idea of government on this God-given equality of men. They said that the people had the right to govern themselves. They said the purpose of government was to protect the unalienable rights of man to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These were sensational proposals. In 1776, a nation based on such new and radical ideas did not appear to have much chance of success. In those days, power centered in Europe. Monarchy was the prevailing form of government. The divine right of kings was still widely accepted. The new nation was small, remote, poor, and in 1776 apparently friendless. Europe did not for a moment believe this new kind of government would work. And to tell the truth, fully a third of our own people did not believe it would work either. We can hardly imagine the courage and the faith it took to issue the Declaration of Independence in those circumstances. Today we can see that the members of the Continental Congress were right. Less than two centuries later, the nation born that day, instead of being small, stretches across a whole continent. Instead of being poor, the United States is wealthier than any other nation in the world. Instead of being friendless, we have strong and steadfast allies. The transformation during these 175 years seems to be complete, but it is not. Some things have not changed at all since 1776. For one thing, freedom is still expensive. It still costs money. It still costs blood. It still calls for courage and endurance, not only in soldiers, but in every man and woman who is free and who is determined to remain free. Freedom must be fought for today, just as our fathers had to fight for freedom when the nation was born. For another thing, the ideas on which our government is founded, the ideas of equality, of God-given rights, of self-government, are still revolutionary. Since 1776, they have spread round the world. In France in 1789, in Latin America in the early 1800s, in many parts of Europe in the mid-19th century, these ideas produced new governments and new nations. Now, in the 20th century, these ideas have stirred the peoples in many countries in the Middle East and Asia to create free governments dedicated to the welfare of the people. The ideas of the American Revolution are still on the march. There's another way in which our situation today is much like that of the Americas in 1776. Now, once more, we are engaged in launching a new idea, one that has been talked about for centuries, but never successfully put into effect. In those earlier days, we were launching a new kind of national government. This time, we are creating a new kind of international organization. We have joined in setting up the United Nations to prevent war and to safeguard peace and freedom. We believe in the United Nations. We believe it is based on the right ideas, as our own country is. We believe it can grow to be strong and accomplish its high purposes. But the United Nations faces stern, determined opposition. This is an old story. The Declaration of Independence was also met by determined opposition. A spokesman for the British King called the Declaration absurd, visionary, and subversive. The idea of freedom and equality and self-government were fiercely opposed in every country by the vested interests and the reactionaries. Today, the idea of an international organization to keep the peace is being attacked and undermined and fought by reactionary forces everywhere, and particularly by the forces of Soviet communism. The United Nations will not succeed without a struggle, just as the Declaration of Independence did not succeed without a struggle. But the American people are not afraid. We've taken our stand beside other free men, because we have known for 175 years that free men must stand together. We've joined in the defense of freedom without hesitation and without fear, because we have known for 175 years that freedom must be defended. This determined stand has cost us much in the past year. I do not intend to dwell upon the money cost on this 4th of July, the day on which we dedicated our fortunes, as well as our lives and our sacred honor, to the cause of freedom. I'm much more deeply concerned that our stand has cost the lives of brave men. I report it with sorrow, but with boundless pride in what they have done. For the men who have fallen in the service of the United States during the past year have died for the same cause as those who fell at Bunker Hill and Gettysburg, in the Argonne Forest, and on the Normandy beaches. They have died in order that government of the people, for the people, by the people, shall not perish from the earth. They have died in order that other men might have peace. On this day, sacred to those who established freedom in the United States, we should all pay tribute to the men who are fighting now to preserve our freedom. The troops under the command of General Ridgway, including not only our own, but those of 16 other free nations, constitute, I believe, the most magnificent army on the face of the globe today. We are all familiar with the splendor of their heroic deeds. I should like to say something to that army, something that I think is felt by free men in every country in the world. Men of the armed forces in Korea, you will go down in history as the first army to fight under the flag of a world organization in the defense of human freedom. You have fought well and without reproach. You have enslaved no free man. You have destroyed no free nation. You are guiltless of any country's blood. Victory may be in your hands, but you are winning a greater thing than military victory, for you are vindicating the idea of freedom under international law. This is an achievement that serves all mankind, for it has brought all men closer to their goal of peace. It is an achievement that may well prove to be a turning point in world history. Our aims in Korea are just as clear and just as simple as the things for which we fought in the American Revolution. We did not fight that war to drive the British out of the North American continent. We did not fight it to destroy the military power of England or to wipe out the British Empire. We fought it for the simple, limited aim of securing the right to be free, the right to govern ourselves. We fought it to secure respect for the principles of the Declaration of Independence. It is much the same with Korea. We're not fighting there to conquer China or to destroy the Soviet Empire. We're fighting for a simple aim, as important to us today as the goal of independence was in the 1776. The aim of securing the right of nations to be free and to live in peace. The Charter of the United Nations says that its purpose is to maintain international peace and security and to take effective collective measures for the suppression of acts of aggression. We are fighting to uphold this purpose of the United Nations. That is what we have been doing in Korea. We have made it clear that those words mean what they say. We have taken collective measures to suppress aggression, and we are suppressing it. We have shown the world that the United Nations Charter is not just a scrap of paper, but something very real and very powerful. To establish this is worth all the sacrifices and all the effort we have been making, because this is the way to peace. Our constant aim in Korea has been peace under the principles of the United Nations. Time and again, since the aggression started, we have proposed that the fighting be stopped and that peace be restored in accordance with those principles. Now, at last, the communist leaders have offered to confer about an armistice. It may be that they have decided to give up their aggression in Korea. If this is true, the road to a peaceful settlement of Korean conflict is open. But we cannot yet be sure that the communist rulers have any such intention. It is still too early to say what they have in mind. I do not wish to speculate on the outcome of any meetings General Ridgway may have with the commanders on the other side. I hope these meetings will be successful. If they are not, it'll be because the communists do not really want peace. Meanwhile, let us keep our heads and be vigilant and ready for whatever may come. We must remember that Korea is only part of a wider conflict. The attack on freedom is worldwide, and it is not simply an attack by fire and sword. It is an attack by the uses of all the weapons that a dictatorship can command: subversion.